Wentworth Prison. Originally one of the mighty border fortresses, it had been built sometime in the late 16th century and added to at intervals over the next 150 years. The sprawling pile of rock now covered nearly 2 acres of ground, sealed behind 3-foot walls of weathered granite. But even granite walls have gates, I thought. I looked up to ask a question, and saw the reluctance still stamped on Dougal's features. "What else?" I demanded. The hazel eyes met mine, unflinching.
"He stood his trial 3 days ago," Dougal said, "and was condemned to hang."
The ice lump was back, with company. I closed my eyes. "How long?" I asked. My voice seemed rather far off to my own ears, and I opened my eyes again, blinking to refocus them in the flickering lantern light. Dougal was shaking his head.
"A dinner ken. Not long, though."
My breath was coming a little easier now, and I was able to unclench my fists. "We'd better hurry, then," I said, still calmly. "How many men are with you?" Instead of answering, Dougal rose and came over to me. Reaching down, he took my hands and pulled me to my feet. The look of sympathy was back, and a deep grief lurking in his eyes frightened me more than anything he'd said so far. He shook his head slowly.
"Nay, lass," he said gently, "there's nothing we can do."
Panicked, I tore my hands away from him. "There is," I said. "There must be. You said he was still alive."
"And I said, not long," he retorted sharply. "The lad's in Wentworth Prison, not the thieves' hole at Cranesmuir. They may hang him today or tomorrow, or not till next week, for all I know of the matter. But there is no way on earth that 10 men can force a way into Wentworth Prison."
"Oh, no?" I was trembling again, but with rage this time. "You don't know that. You don't know what might be done. You're just not willing to risk your skin or your miserable profit." I flung an arm accusingly at the piled bundles. Dougal grappled with me, seizing my flailing arms. I hammered his chest in a frenzy of grief and rage. He ignored the blows and put his arms around me, pulling me tight against him and holding me until I ceased struggling.
"Claire."
It was the first time he had ever used my first name, and it frightened me still further.
"Claire,"
he said again, loosening his grip so that I could look up at him.
"Do you not think I'd do all I could to free the lad? Did I think there was the slightest chance? Damn it, he's my own foster son. But there is no chance. None."
He shook me slightly to emphasize his words.
"Jamie wouldn't have me throw away good men's lives in a vain venture. You know that as well as I do."
I could keep back the tears no longer. They burned down my icy cheeks as I pushed against him, seeking to free myself. He held me tighter, though, trying to force my head against his shoulder.
"Claire, my dear," he said, voice gentler, "my heart's sore for the lad, and for you. Do you come away with me? I'll take you safe."
"To my own house," he added hastily, feeling me stiffen, "not to Leoch." "To your house?" I said slowly. A horrible suspicion was beginning to form in my mind.
"Aye," he said. "You dinna think I'd take you back to Cranesmuir, surely?"
He smiled briefly before the stern features relaxed back into seriousness.
"Nay, I'll take you to Binacht. You'll be safe there."
"Safe?" I said. "Or helpless?" His arms dropped away at the tone of my voice.
"What do you mean?"
The pleasant voice was suddenly cold. I felt rather cold myself and pulled my cloak together as I moved away from him. "You kept Jamie away from his home by telling him his sister had borne a child to Randall," I said, "so that you and that precious brother of yours would have a chance to lure him into your camp. But now the English have him, you've lost any chance of controlling the property through Jamie." I backed up another step, swallowing. "You were party to your sister's marriage contract. It was by your insistence, yours and Colum's, that Brochturach might be held by a woman. You think that if Jamie dies, Broch Turek will belong to me. Or to you, if you can seduce or force me into marrying you.
What?
His voice was incredulous.
You think this is all some plot? Saint Agnes, do you think I'm lying to you?
I shook my head, keeping my distance. I didn't trust him an inch. No, I believe you. If Jamie weren't in prison, you'd never dare to tell me he was. It's too easy to check that. Nor do I think you betrayed him to the English. Not even you could do something like that to your own blood. Besides, if you had, and word of it ever reached your men, they'd turn on you in a second. They'd tolerate a lot in you, but not treachery against your own kinsmen.
As I spoke, I was reminded of something.
Was it you who attacked Jamie near the border last year?
The heavy brows rose with surprise. Me? No. I found the lad near death and saved him. Does that sound as though I meant him harm?
Under cover of my cloak, I ran my hand down my thigh, feeling for the comforting bulk of my dagger. If it wasn't you, who was it?
I dunno ken.
The handsome face was wary, but not hiding anything.
'Twas one of three men, broken men, outlaws, that hunted wi' Jamie then. All of them accused each other, and there was no way of finding out the truth of the matter. Not then.
He shrugged, the travelling cloak falling back from one broad shoulder.
It doesna matter much now. Twa of the men are dead and the third in prison. Over another matter, but it makes little difference, do you think?
No, I don't suppose so. It was, in a way, a relief to find that he wasn't a murderer, whatever else he might be. He had no reason to lie to me now. So far as he knew, I was completely helpless. Alone, he could compel me to do whatever he wished. Or at least he likely thought so.
I took a grip on the handle of my dirk. The light was poor in the cave, but I was watching carefully, and I could see indecision flicker momentarily across his face as he chose his next move. He stepped toward me, hand out, but stopped when he saw me flinch away.
Claire, my sweet Claire.
The voice was soft now, and he ran an insinuating hand lightly down my arm. So he had decided to try seduction rather than compulsion.
I know why you talk so cool to me, and why you think ill of me. You know that I burn for you, Claire. And it's true. I've wanted you since the night of the gathering when I kissed your sweet lips.
He had two fingers resting lightly on my shoulder, inching toward my neck.
If I'd been a free man when Randall threatened you, I'd have wed you myself on the spot and sent my man to the devil for you.
He was moving his body gradually closer, crowding me against the stone wall of the cavern. His fingertips moved to my throat, tracing the line of my cloak fastening. He must have seen my face then, for he stopped his advance, though he left his hand where it was, resting lightly above the rapid pulse that beat in my throat.
"Even so," he said, "even feeling as I do, for I'll hide it from you no longer. Even so, you couldn't imagine I'd abandon Jamie if there were any hope of saving him. Jamie Fraser is the closest thing I've got to a son."
"Not quite," I said. "There's your real son, or perhaps two by now." The fingers on my throat increased their pressure just for a second, then dropped away.
"What do you mean?"
And this time, all pretense, all games were dispensed with. The hazel eyes were intent and the full lips a grim line in the russet beard. He was very large and very close to me, but I had gone too far already for caution. "It means I know who Hamish's father really is," I said. He had been half expecting it, and had his face well under control, but the last month spent telling fortunes hadn't been in vain. I saw the tiny flicker of shock that widened his eyes, and the sudden panic, swiftly quelled, that tightened the corners of his mouth. "Bullseye!" In spite of the danger, I knew a moment's fierce exultation. I had been right then, and the knowledge might just possibly be the weapon I needed.
"Do you, then?"
he said softly. "Yes," I said.
and I imagine Colum knows as well. That stopped him for a moment. The hazel eyes narrowed, and I wondered for an instant whether he was armed. "He thought it was Jamie for a time, I think," I said, staring directly into his eyes, "because of the rumours. You must have started those, feeding them to Gilles Duncan.
Why?
Because Colum got suspicious of Jamie and started to question Letitia. She couldn't hold out for long against him. Or was it that Gilles thought you were Letitia's lover, and you told her it was Jamie to quiet her suspicions? She's a jealous woman, but she can't have any reason to protect you now."
Dougal smiled cruelly. The ice never left his eyes.
"No, she can't,"
he agreed, still speaking softly.
"The witch is dead."
"Dead?"
The shock must have shown as plainly on my face as in my voice. His smile broadened. "Oh, aye," he said. "Burnt. Stuck feet first in a barrel of pitch and heaped about with dry peats. Bound to a stake and lit like a torch. Sent to the devil in a pillar of flame under the branches of a rowan tree."
I thought at first this merciless recitation of detail was meant to impress me, but I was wrong. I shifted to one side, and as the light shone fresh on his face, I could see the lines of grief etched around his eyes. It wasn't a catalogue of horror then, but a lashing of himself.
I felt no pity for him under the circumstances.
"So you were fond of her," I said coldly.
"Much good it did her, or the child. What did you do with that?"
He shrugged.
"So it placed in a good home. A son and a healthy babe, for all its mother was a witch and an adulteress."
"And its father an adulterer and a betrayer," I snapped. "Your wife, your mistress, your nephew, your brother. Is there anyone you haven't betrayed and deceived? You...
I choked on the words, quite sick with loathing.
"I don't know why I'm surprised," I said, trying to speak calmly. "If you've no loyalty to your king, I suppose there's no reason to think you'd feel it for your nephew or your brother either."
His head snapped round and he glared at me. He raised his thick, dark brows, the same shape as Colum's, as Jamie's, as Hamish's. The deep-set eyes, the broad cheekbones, the beautifully shaped skull. Old Jacob Mackenzie's legacy was a strong one.
A big hand clamped hard on my shoulder.
"My brother? You think I'd betray my brother?"
For some reason, that had stung him. His face was dark with anger. "You just admitted that you did." And then I realized.
"The both of you," I said slowly.
"You did it together. You and Colum. Together, as you've always done things."
I pulled his hand off my shoulder and flung it back at him. "Colum couldn't be chieftain unless you would go to war for him. He couldn't hold the clan together without you to travel for him, to collect the rents and settle the claims. He couldn't ride, he couldn't travel, and he couldn't father a son to pass the chieftainship on to. And you had no son by Mora. You swore to be his arms and legs." I was beginning to feel a little hysterical by this time. "Why shouldn't you be his cock as well?"
Dougal had lost his anger. He stood watching me speculatively for a moment. Deciding that I was going nowhere, he sat down on one of the bales of goods and waited for me to finish.
"So you did it with Colum's knowledge. Was Letitia willing?" Knowing by now just what sort of ruthlessness they possessed, I wouldn't put it past the brothers Mackenzie to have forced her.
Dougal nodded. His anger had evaporated.
"Oh, aye, willing enough. She didn't fancy me particularly, but she wanted a child. Enough to take me to her bed for the 3 months it took to start Hamish. A boring damn job it was, too,"
Dougal added reflectively, scraping a bit of mud from his boot heel.
"I'd as soon swive a warm bowl of milk pudding."
"And did you tell Colum that?" I asked.
Hearing the edge in my voice, he looked up. He regarded me levelly for a moment, then a faint smile lightened his face.
"No," he said quietly,
No, I didn't tell him that.
He looked down at his hands, turning them over as though looking for some secret hidden in the lines of his palms.
I told him, he said softly, not looking at me, that she was tender and sweet as a ripe peach, and all that a man could want in a woman.
He closed his hands abruptly and looked up at me. That momentary glimpse of Colum's brother submerged once more in the sardonic eyes of Dougal Mackenzie.
"Tender and sweet is not precisely what I'd say of you," he observed, "but all that a man could want."
The deep-set hazel eyes travelled slowly downward over my body, lingering on the roundness of breast and hip that showed through my open cloak. One hand moved unconsciously back and forth, stroking lightly across the muscles of his thigh as he watched me.
"Who knows," he said, as though to himself. "I might have yet another son, legitimate this time." "True," he tilted his head appraisingly, looking at my midsection. "It hasn't happened yet with Jamie. You may be barren, but I'll take the chance. The property is worth it, at any rate."
He stood suddenly and took a step toward me.
"Who knows," he said again, very softly, "if I were to plough that pretty brown-haired furrow and seed it deep each day."
The shadows on the cavern wall shifted suddenly as he took another step toward me.
"Well, you took your bloody time about it," I said crossly.
A look of incredulous shock spread across his features before he realised that I was looking beyond him, toward the cave mouth.
"It didn't seem mannerly to interrupt," said Murta, advancing into the cave behind a loaded pair of flintlock pistols.
He held one trained on Dougal, using the other to gesture with.
"Unless you mean to accept that last proposal here and now, I'd suggest you leave. And if you do mean to accept it, then I'll leave."
"Nobody's leaving yet," I said shortly. "Sit down," I said to Dougal.
He was still standing, staring at Murta as though at an apparition.
"Where's Rupert?"
he demanded, finding his voice.
"Oh, Rupert."
Murta scratched his chin thoughtfully with the muzzle of one pistol.
"He's likely made it to Belladrum by now. Should be back before dawn," he added helpfully, "with a keg of rum he thinks you sent him to fetch. The rest of your men are still asleep in Quinborough."
Dougal had the grace to laugh, if a little grudgingly. He sat down again, hands on his knees, and glanced from me to Murta and back again. There was a momentary silence.
"Well," Dougal inquired, "now what?"
That, I realised, was rather a good question. Surprised at finding Dougal instead of Jamie, shocked by his revelations and infuriated at his consequent proposals, I had had no time to think of what ought to be done. Luckily, Murta was better prepared. Well, after all, he hadn't been occupied in fighting off lecherous advances.
"We'll need money," he said promptly, "and men."
He cast an eye appraisingly over the bundles stacked against the wall.
"Nay," he said thoughtfully, "that'll be for King James, but we'll take what you've got on your person."
The small black eyes swiveled back to Dougal, and the muzzle of one pistol gestured gently in the vicinity of his sporran. One thing to be said for life in the Highlands was that it apparently gave one a certain fatalistic attitude. With a sigh, Dougal reached into the sporran and tossed a small purse at my feet.
20 gold pieces and 30-odd shillings," he said,
lifting one brow in my direction.
"Take it, and welcome."
Seeing my look of scepticism, he shook his head.
"Nay, I mean it. Think what you like of me. Jamie's my sister's son, and if you can free him, then God be with you. But you can't."
His tone was final. He looked at Murta, still holding his pistols steady.
"As to the men, no. If you and the lass mean to commit suicide, I can't stop you. I'll even offer to bury you, one on either side of Jamie. But you'll not take my men to hell with you, pistols or no."
He crossed his arms and leaned back against the cavern wall, calmly watching us.
Murto's hands didn't waver from his aim. His eyes flickered toward me, though.
Did I wish him to shoot?
"I'll make you a bargain," I said. Dougal raised one brow.
"You're in a better position to bargain than I am at present," he said. "What's your offer?"
"Let me talk to your men," I said. "And if they'll come with me of their own accord, then let them. If not, we'll go as we came, and we'll hand back your purse as well."
One side of his mouth came up in a lopsided smile. He looked me over carefully, as though assessing my persuasiveness and my skills as an orator. Then he sat back, hands on his knees. He nodded once.
"Done,"
he said. In the event, we left the Glen of the Cave with Dougal's purse and 5 men, in addition to Murta and myself. Rupert, John Whitlow, Willie McMurtry, and the twin brothers Rufus and Geordie Coulter. It was Rupert's decision that swayed the others. I could still see, with a feeling of grim satisfaction, the look on Dougal's face when his squat, black-bearded lieutenant eyed me speculatively, then patted the dags at his belt and said,
"Aye, lass, why not?"
Wentworth Prison was 35 miles away. A half-hour's ride in a fast car over good roads. 2 days' hard slog over half-frozen mud by horseback.
"Not long."
Dougal's words echoed in my ears and kept me in my saddle long past the point where I might have dropped from fatigue. My body was pushed to its limits to keep to the saddle through the long, weary miles, but my mind was free to worry. To keep it from thoughts of Jamie, I spent the time remembering my interview in the cave with Dougal, and the last thing he had said to me. Standing outside the small cave, waiting as Rupert and his companions brought their horses down from a hiding place higher up the glen, Dougal had turned to me abruptly.
"I've a message for you," he had said. "From the witch."
"From Gili?"
To say I was startled was the least of it. I couldn't make out his face in the dark, but I saw his head tilt in affirmation.
"I saw her the once," he said softly, "when I came to take the child."
Under other circumstances, I might have felt some sympathy for him, parting for the last time from his mistress, who was condemned to the stake, holding the child they had made together, a son whom he could never acknowledge. As it was, my voice was icy.
"What did she say?"
He paused. I wasn't sure if it was merely the disinclination to reveal information, or if he was trying to make sure of his words. Apparently it was the latter, for he spoke carefully.
"She said if ever I saw you again, I was to tell you 2 things, just as she told them to me. The first was, 'I think it is possible, but I do not know.' And the second was just numbers. She made me say them over to be sure I had them right, for I was to tell them to you in a certain order. The numbers were 1, 9, 6, and 7.
The tall figure turned toward me in the dark, inquiring.
"Mean anything to you?"
"No," I said, and turned away to my horse. But it did, of course, mean something to me. "I think it is possible." There was only 1 thing she could mean by that. She had thought, though she didn't know, that it was possible to go back through the circle of stone to my proper place. Clearly she hadn't tried it herself, but had chosen, to her cost, to stay. Likely she had had her own reasons. Dougal, perhaps. As for the numbers, I thought I knew what those meant, too. She had told them to him separately for the sake of a secrecy which must have gone bone deep in her by that time. But they were all part of 1 number, really. 1, 9, 6, 7. 1967. The year of her disappearance into the past. I felt a small thrill of curiosity and deep regret. What a pity that I hadn't seen the vaccination mark on her arm until it was too late. And yet, had I seen it sooner, would I have gone back to the Circle of Stone, perhaps with her help, and left Jamie? Jamie. The thought of him was a leaden weight in my mind, a pendulum swinging slowly at the end of a rope. Not long. The road stretched endless and dreary before us, sometimes petering out altogether into frozen marshes or open sheets of water that had once been meadows and moors. In a freezing drizzle that would soon turn to snow, we reached our goal near evening of the second day. The building loomed up black against the overcast sky. Built in the shape of a gigantic cube, 400 feet on a side, with a tower on each corner, it could house 300 prisoners, plus the 40 soldiers of the garrison, and their commander, the civilian governor and his staff, and the 4 dozen cooks, orderlies, grooms, and other menials necessary for the running of the establishment, Wentworth Prison. I looked up at the menacing walls of greenish argyle granite, 2 feet thick at the base. Tiny windows pierced the walls here and there. A few were beginning to wink with light. Others, serving what I assumed were the prisoners' cells, stayed dark. I swallowed. Seeing the massive edifice with its impenetrable walls, its monumental gate, and its red-coated guards, I began to have doubts. What if... My mouth was dry, and I had to stop and lick my lips. What if we can't do it? Murtagh's expression was the same as always, grim-mouthed and dour, narrow chin receding into the grimy neck of his shirt. It didn't alter as he turned to me.
"Then Dougal will bury us, William, one on either side," he answered. "Come on, there's work to be done."
Part 7. Sanctuary. Chapter 35. Wentworth Prison. Sir Fletcher Gordon was a short and portly man whose striped silk waistcoat fitted him like a second skin. Slope-shouldered and paunch-bellied, he looked rather like a large ham seated in the governor's wheel-backed chair. The bald head and rich pinkish colour of his complexion did little to dispel this impression, though few hams boasted such bright blue eyes. He turned over the sheaf of papers on his desk with a slow, deliberate forefinger.
"Yes, here it is," he said, after an interminable pause to read a page. "Fraser, James, convicted of murder, sentenced to hang. Now where's the warrant of execution?"
He paused again, shuffling near-sightedly through the papers. I dug my fingers deep into the satin of my reticule, willing my face to remain expressionless.
"Oh, yes. Date of execution, December 23rd. Yes, we still have him."
I swallowed, relaxing my hold on my bag, torn between exultation and panic. He was still alive then, for another 2 days. And he was nearby, somewhere in the same building with me. The knowledge surged through my veins with a rush of adrenaline, and my hands trembled. I sat forward in the visitor's chair, trying to look winsomely appealing. "May I see him, Sir Fletcher, just for a moment, in case he might wish me to convey a message to his family?" In the guise of an English friend of the Fraser family, I had found it reasonably easy to gain admittance to Wentworth, and to the office of Sir Fletcher, civilian governor of the prison. It was dangerous to ask to see Jamie. Not knowing my cover story, he might well give me away if he saw me suddenly without warning. For that matter, I might give myself away. I wasn't at all sure that I could maintain my precarious self-control if I saw him. But the next step was clearly to find out where he was. In this huge stone rabbit warren, the chances of finding him without direction were almost nil. Sir Fletcher frowned, considering. Plainly he considered this request from a mere family acquaintance a nuisance, but he was not an unfeeling man. Finally he shook his head reluctantly.
"No, my dear. No, I'm afraid I really cannot allow that. We are rather crowded at present, and haven't sufficient facilities to permit private interviews. And the man is presently in..."
He consulted his pile of papers again.
In one of the large cells in the West Block, with several other condemned felons. It would be extremely perilous for you to visit him there, or at all. The man is a dangerous prisoner, you understand. I see here that we have been keeping him in chains since his arrival.
I gripped my bag again, this time to keep from striking him. He shook his head again, plump chest rising and falling with his laboured breathing.
No, if you were an immediate member of his family, perhaps.
He looked up, blinking. I clamped my jaw tightly, determined to give nothing away. Surely a slight show of agitation was reasonable, under the circumstances.
But perhaps, my dear...
He seemed struck by sudden inspiration. He got ponderously to his feet and went to an inner door where a uniformed soldier stood on guard. He murmured to the man, who nodded once and vanished. Sir Fletcher came back to his desk, pausing on the way to retrieve a decanter and glasses from the top of a cabinet. I accepted his offer of claret. I needed it. We were both halfway through the second glass by the time the guard returned.
He marched in without invitation, placed a wooden box on the desk at Sir Fletcher's elbow, and turned to march out again. I caught his eye lingering on me, and modestly lowered my own gaze.
I was wearing a gown borrowed from a lady of Rupert's acquaintance in the nearby town, and from the scent that saturated the dress and its matching reticule, I had a reasonably good idea just what this particular lady's profession was. I hoped the guard didn't recognise the gown. Draining his cup, Sir Fletcher set it down and pulled the box toward him. It was a plain, square box of unfinished wood with a sliding lid. There were letters chalked on the lid. I could read them, even upside down. Fraser, they read. Sir Fletcher slid back the lid, peered inside for a moment, then closed the box and pushed it toward me.
"The prisoner's personal effects," he explained. "Customarily, we send them to whomever the prisoner designates as next of kin after execution. This man, though," he shook his head, "has refused altogether to say anything about his family. Some estrangement, no doubt. Not unusual, of course, but regrettable under the circumstances. I hesitate to make the request, Mrs. Beecham, but I thought that perhaps, since you are acquainted with the family, you would consider taking it upon yourself to convey his effects to the appropriate person."
I didn't trust myself to speak, but nodded and buried my nose in my cup of claret. Sir Fletcher seemed relieved, whether at disposing of the box or at the thought of my imminent departure. He sat back, wheezing slightly, and smiled expansively at me.
"That is very kind of you, Mrs. Beecham. I know such a thing cannot but be a painful duty to a young woman of feeling, and I am most sensible of your kindness in undertaking it, I do assure you."
Not at all," I stammered. I managed to stand up and to gather up the box. It measured about 8 inches by 6 and was 4 or 5 inches deep, a small, light box to hold the remains of a man's life. I knew the things it held. 3 fishing lines, neatly coiled, a cork stuck with fish hooks, a flint and steel, a small piece of broken glass, edges blunt with wear, various small stones that looked interesting or had a good feel between the fingers, a dried mole's foot carried as a charm against rheumatism, a Bible, or perhaps they had let him keep that. I hoped so. A ruby ring, if it hadn't been stolen. And a small wooden snake, carved of cherry wood, with the name Sawney scratched on its underside. I paused at the door, gripping the frame with my fingers to steady myself. Sir Fletcher, following courteously to see me out, was at my side in a moment.
"Mrs. Beecham, are you feeling faint, my dear? Guard, a chair."
I could feel the prickles of a cold sweat breaking out along the sides of my face, but I managed to smile and wave away the proffered chair. I wanted more than anything to get out of there. I needed fresh air in large quantities. And I needed to be alone, to cry. "No, I'm quite all right," I said, trying to sound convincing. "It's only a bit close in here, perhaps. No, I shall be perfectly all right. My groom is waiting outside in any case. Forcing myself to stand up straight and smile, I had a thought. It might not help, but it couldn't hurt. Oh, Sir Fletcher? Still worried by my appearance, he was all gallantry and attention.
Yes, my dear.
It occurred to me, how sad for a young man in this situation to be estranged from his family. I thought perhaps, if he wished to write to them, a letter of reconciliation perhaps, I would be pleased to deliver it to his mother.
You are thoughtfulness itself, my dear.
Sir Fletcher was jovial. Now it seemed I wasn't going to collapse on his carpet after all.
Of course, I will inquire. Where are you staying, my dear? If there is a letter, I shall have it sent to you.
Well, I was doing better with the smile, though it felt pasted on my face. That is rather uncertain at the moment. I have several relatives and close acquaintances in the town with whom I fear I shall be obliged to stay in turn in order to avoid offending anyone, you see. I managed a small laugh. So if it does not disturb you too much, perhaps my groom could call to inquire for the letter?
Of course, that will do excellently, my dear, excellently.
And with a quick glance back at his decanter, he took my arm to escort me to the gate.
Better, lassie.
Rupert pushed back the curtain of my hair to peer at my face.
You look like an ill-cured pork belly. Here, better have a bit more.
I shook my head at the proffered whiskey flask and sat up, wiping the damp rag he had brought across my face. No, I'm all right now. Escorted by Murta, who was disguised as my groom, I had barely made it out of sight of the prison before sliding off my horse and being sick in the snow. There I remained, weeping, with Jamie's box clutched to my bosom, until Murta had gathered me up bodily, forced me to mount, and led me to the small inn in Wentworth Town, where Rupert had found lodgings. We were in an upper room, from which the bulk of the prison was barely visible in the gathering dusk.
"Is the lad dead, then?"
Rupert's broad face, half obscured by his beard, was grave and kind, lacking any of its usual clowning. I shook my head and took a deep breath. "Not yet." After hearing my story, Rupert paced slowly around the room, pushing his lips in and out as he thought. Murta sat still, as usual, no sign of agitation on his features. "He would have made a wonderful poker player," I thought. Rupert returned, sinking down on the bed beside me with a sigh.
"Well, he's alive still, and that's the most important thing. Damned if I see what to do next, though. We've no way to get into the police." "Aye, we have," Murta said suddenly. "Thanks to the wee lass's thought about the letter." "Mm-hmm. One man, though. And only so far as the governor's office. But aye, it's a start."
Rupert drew his dirk and idly scratched his thick beard with the point.
"It's a damn big place to search."
"I know where he is," I said, feeling better with the planning and the knowledge that my companions weren't giving up, no matter how hopeless our enterprise seemed. "At least, I know which wing he's in."
"Do you, then?
He replaced the dirk and resumed his pacing, stopping to demand,
"How much money have you, lass?"
I fumbled in the pocket of my gown. I had Dougal's purse, the money Jenny had forced me to take, and my string of pearls. Rupert rejected the pearls, but took the purse, pouring a stream of coins into the palm of one capacious hand.
"That'll do,"
he said, jingling them experimentally. He cocked an eye at the Coulter twins.
"You two all laddies and Willie, come with me. John and Murta can stay here with the lassie."
"Where are you going?" I asked. He poured the coins into his sponge, keeping back one, which he tossed meditatively in the air.
"Och," he said vaguely, "happen there's another in the other side of the town. The guards from the prison go there when they're off duty, for it's closer and the drink's a penny cheaper."
He flipped the coin with his thumb, and turning his hand, caught it between two knuckles. I watched it, with a growing idea of what he intended.
"Is that so?" I said. "I wouldn't suppose they play cards there too, would they?"
"I wouldn't a ken, lassie, wouldn't a ken," he answered.
He tossed the coin once more and clapped his hands together, trapping it, then spread his hands apart to show nothing but thin air. He smiled, teeth white in the black beard.
"But we might go and see, no?"
He snapped his fingers, and the coin appeared once more between them. Shortly past 1 o'clock on the following afternoon, I passed again beneath the spiked portcullis that had guarded the gate of Wentworth since its construction in the late 16th century. It had lost very little of its forbidding aspect in the succeeding 200 years, and I touched the dagger in my pocket for courage. Sir Fletcher should now be well dug in at his midday repast, according to the information Rupert and his assistant spies had extracted from the prison guards during their foray the evening before. They had staggered in, red-eyed and reeking of ale, just before dawn. All Rupert would say in response to my questions was, "Och, lassie, all it takes to win is luck. It takes skill to lose." He curled up in the corner then, and went soundly to sleep, leaving me to pace the floor in frustration, as I had been doing all night. He woke an hour later, though, clear-eyed and clear-headed, and laid out the rudiments of the plan I was about to put into execution.
"Sir Fletcher does not allow anyone or anything to disturb his meals," he said. "Anyone wanting him then must just go on wanting till he's done with his food and drink. And after the midday meal it's his habit to retire to his quarters for a wee sleep."
Murta, in the character of my groom, had arrived a quarter of an hour previously and had been admitted without difficulty. Presumably, he would be shown to Sir Fletcher's office and asked to wait. While there, he was to search the office, first for a plan of the West Wing, and then, on the off chance, for keys that might open the cells. I hung back a bit, glancing at the sky to judge the time. If I arrived before he had sat down, I might be invited to join Sir Fletcher for luncheon, which would be highly inconvenient. But Rupert's card-playing acquaintances among the guards had assured him that the governor's habits were invariable. The bell for dinner was rung promptly at 1, and the soup served 5 minutes later. The guard on duty at the entrance was the same as the day before. He looked surprised, but greeted me courteously.
"So vexing," I said. "I had meant my groom to bring a small present for Sir Fletcher, as some return for his kindness to me yesterday. But I found that the silly man had ridden off without it, and so I was obliged to follow with it myself, hoping to catch him up. Has he arrived already?"
I displayed the small package I carried and smiled, thinking that it would help if I had dimples. Since I hadn't, I settled for a brilliant display of teeth. It seemed to be sufficient. I was admitted and led through the corridors of the prison toward the governor's office. Though this part of the castle was decently furnished, there was little mistaking the place for anything other than a prison. There was a smell about the place, which I imagined as the smell of misery and fear, though I supposed it was no more than the niff of ancient squalor and an absence of drains. The guard allowed me to precede him down the hall, following discreetly so as not to step on my cloak. And a damn good thing he did, for I rounded the corner towards Sir Fletcher's office a few feet ahead of him, just in time to see Murta through the open door, dragging the unconscious form of the office guard behind the enormous desk. I took one step back and dropped my package onto the stone floor. There was a shattering of glass, and the air was filled with the smothering aroma of peach brandy.
"Oh, dear," I said, "what have I done?"
While the guard was calling for a prisoner to clear up the mess, I tactfully murmured something about waiting for Sir Fletcher in his private office, slipped in, and hastily shut the door behind me.
"What the bloody hell have you done?" I snapped at Murta.
He looked up from his rummaging of the body, unconcerned at my tone.
"Sir Fletcher doesn't keep keys in his office," he informed me in a low voice, "but this wee laddie has a set."
He pulled the huge ring free of the man's coat, careful to keep the keys from jingling. I dropped to my knees behind him.
"Oh, good show," I said.
I cast an eye over the prostrate soldier, still breathing at least. "What about a plan of the prison?" He shook his head.
"Not that either. But my friend here told me a bit while we waited. The condemned cells are on the same floor as this, in the middle of the west corridor. They're free cells, though, and I couldn't ask more than that. He was a bit suspicious as it was."
"It's enough, I hope. All right, give me the keys and get out."
"Me? It's you should leave, lassie, and right smart, too."
He glanced at the door, but there was no sound on the other side. "No, it has to be me," I said, reaching again for the keys. "Listen," I said impatiently, "if they find you wandering round the prison with a bunch of keys and the guard here laid out like a mackerel, we're both done for. Because why didn't I cry out for help?" I snatched the keys and crammed them in my pocket with some difficulty. Murta was still sceptical, but had risen to his feet.
"And if you're caught?" he demanded.
"I swoon," I said crisply. "And when I recover, eventually, I say that I saw you apparently murdering the guard and fled in terror with no idea where I was going. I lost my way looking for help." He nodded slowly.
"Aye, all right."
He moved toward the door, then stopped.
"But why did I..."
"Oh!" He crossed swiftly to the desk and pulled out one drawer after another, stirring the contents with one hand and tossing items onto the floor with the other.
"Theft,"
he explained, coming back to the door. He opened it a crack, looking out.
"If it's theft, shouldn't you take something?"
I suggested, looking about for something small and portable. I picked up an enameled snuff box.
"This, perhaps."
He made an impatient gesture for me to put it down, still peering through the crack.
"Nay, lass. If I'm found with Sir Fletcher's property, that's a hanging offence. Attempted theft is only flogging or mutilation."
"Oh." I put the snuff box down hastily and stood behind him, peering over his shoulder. The hall seemed empty.
"I go first," he said. "If I meet anyone, I'll draw him off. Wait to the count of 30, then follow. We'll meet you in the small wood to the north."
He opened the door, then paused and turned back.
"If you're caught, mind you throw the keys away."
Before I could speak, he was through the door like an eel and down the corridor, moving silently as a shadow. It seemed to take an eternity to find the West Wing, dodging through the corridors of the old castle, peering around corners and hiding behind columns. I saw only one guard on my way, though, and managed to avoid him by diving back around a corner, pressing myself to the wall with hammering heart until he passed. Once I found the West Wing, though, I had little doubt that I was in the right place. There were three large doors in the corridor, each with a tiny barred window from which I could catch no more than a frustrating glimpse of the room behind it. "Eeny, meeny, miny, mo," I muttered to myself, and headed for the centre cell. The keys on the ring were unlabeled, but of different sizes. Clearly, only one of three big ones would fit the lock before me. Naturally, it was the third one. I took a deep breath as the lock clicked, then wiped my sweating hands on my skirt and shoved the door open. I sorted frantically through the stinking mass of men in the cell, stepping over outstretched feet and legs, pushing past heavy bodies that moved with maddening sluggishness out of my way. The stir occasioned by my abrupt entrance had spread. Those who had been asleep amid the filth on the floor began to sit up, roused by the rippling murmur of astonishment. Some were manacled to the walls. The chains grated and clanked in the half-light as they moved. I grabbed one of the standing men, a brown-bearded clansman in a ragged yellow and green tartan. The bones of his arm under my hand were frighteningly near the skin. The English wasted little extra food on their prisoners.
"James Fraser, a big red-headed man. Is he in this cell? Where is he?"
He was already moving toward the door with the others who were not chained,
but paused a moment to glance down at me. The prisoners by now had seized the idea and were pouring through the open door in a shuffling flood, peering and murmuring to each other.
Who? Fraser? Oh, it took him a while this morning.
The man shrugged and pushed at my hands, trying to shake me off. I took hold of his belt with a grip that halted him in his tracks. Where did they take him? Who took him?
I dinna ken where. Was yon captain Randall took him. A pinch-faced snark he is.
With an impatient wrench he freed himself and headed for the door with a step born of long-nourished purpose. Randall! I stood stunned for a moment, jostled by the escaping men, deaf to the shouts of the chained. Finally, I shook myself from my stupor and tried to think. Geordie had watched the castle since dawn. No one had left in the morning save a small kitchen party going to fetch supplies. So they were still here, somewhere. Randall was a captain, likely no one ranked higher in a prison garrison save Sir Fletcher himself. Presumably, Randall could thus command the castle's resources so as to provide him with some suitable spot in which to torture a prisoner at his leisure. And torture it surely was. Even if it was meant to end in hanging, the man I had seen at Fort William was a cat by nature. He could no more resist the chance to play with this particular mouse than he could alter his height or the colour of his eyes. I took a deep breath, resolutely shoving aside thoughts of what might have happened since this morning, and charged out the door myself, colliding full force with an English redcoat rushing in. The man reeled backward, staggering with tiny running steps to keep his balance. Thrown off balance myself, I crashed heavily into the door jamb, numbing my left side and banging my head. I clutched the doorpost for support, the ringing in my ears chiming with the echoes of Rupert's voice.
You have a moment of surprise, lass. Use it.
It was open to question, I thought dizzily, who was more surprised. I groped madly for the pocket that held my dagger, cursing my stupidity for not having entered the cell with it already drawn. The English soldier, balance recovered, was staring at me with his mouth agape, but I could feel my precious moment of surprise already slipping away. Abandoning the elusive pocket, I stooped and drew the dagger from my stocking in a move that continued upward with all the force I could muster. The knife point took the advancing soldier just under the chin as he reached for his belt. His hands rose halfway to his throat, then, with a look of surprise, he staggered back against the wall and slid down it in slow motion as the life drained away from him. Like me, he had come to investigate without bothering to draw his weapon first, and that small oversight had just cost him his life. The grace of God had saved me from this mistake. I could afford no more. Feeling very cold, I stepped over the twitching body, careful not to look. I dashed back the way I had come, as far as the turning by the stairs. There was a spot here by the wall where I would be sheltered from view from both directions. I leaned against the wall and indulged myself in a moment of trembling nausea. Wiping my sweaty hands on my skirt, I dredged the dirk from its hidden pocket. It was now my only weapon. I had neither time nor stomach enough to retrieve my sock knife. Perhaps that was as well, I thought, rubbing my fingers on my bodice. There had been surprisingly little blood, and I shrank from the thought of the gush that would follow if I pulled the knife free. Dagger now safely in hand, I peered cautiously out into the corridor. The prisoners I had inadvertently released had gone to the left. I had no idea what they were set on doing, but they would likely occupy the English while they were doing it. With no reason to pick one direction over another for my search, it made sense to move away from whatever commotion they caused. The light from the high-slit windows fell aslant behind me. This was the west side of the castle, then. I must keep my bearings as I moved, since Rupert would be waiting for me near the south gate. Stairs. I forced my numbed mind to think, trying to reason my way to the spot I was looking for. If you wanted to torture someone, presumably you wanted both privacy and soundproofing. Both considerations pointed to an isolated dungeon as the most likely spot. and the dungeons in castles such as this were customarily underground, where tons of earth muffled any cries, and darkness hid all cruelty from the eyes of those responsible. The wall rounded into a curve at the end of the corridor. I had reached one of the four corner towers, and the towers had stairs. The spiral stair opened around another curve, the wedge-shaped steps plunging down in dizzying flights that deceived the eye and twisted the ankles. The plunge from the relative light of the corridor into the gloom of the stairwell made it even harder to judge the distance from one stair to the next, and I slipped several times, bucking my knuckles and skinning my palms on the stone walls as I caught myself. The stairway yielded one benefit. From a narrow window let in to save the stairwell from total darkness, I could see the main courtyard. At least I could now orient myself. A small group of soldiers was drawn up in neat red lines for inspection, but not, apparently, to witness the summary punishment of a Scottish rebel. There was a gibbet in the courtyard, black and foreboding, but unoccupied. The sight of it was like a blow in the stomach. Tomorrow morning. I clattered down the stairs, heedless of scraped elbows and stubbed toes. Hitting the bottom in a swish of skirts, I stopped to listen. Dead silence all around, but at least this part of the castle was in use. There were torches in the wall sconces, dyeing the granite blocks in pools of flickering red, each pool ebbing into darkness at its edges before the pool of the next torch leached into light again. Smoke from the torches hung in grey swirls along the vaulted roof of the corridor. There was only one way to go from this point. I went, dagger still gripped at the ready. It was eerie to be pacing softly down this corridor. I had seen similar dungeons before, as a day-tripper, visiting historic castles with Frank. But then the massive granite blocks had been stripped of their menace by the glare of fluorescent tubes hung from the arches of the cavernous ceiling. I remembered recoiling from the small, dank chambers, even in those days, when they had been in disuse for over a century. Seeing the remnants of old and horrible ways, the thick doors and the rusting manacles on the wall, I'd been able, I thought, to imagine the torments of those imprisoned in these forbidding cells. I would have laughed now at my naivety. There were some things, as Dougal said, that the imagination was simply not equal to. I tiptoed past bolted doors, 3 inches thick, thick enough to smother any sound from inside. Bending close to the floor, I checked for a strip of light at the base of each door. Prisoners might be left to rot in darkness, but Randall would need to see what he was doing. The floor here was gummy with ancient dirt, covered with a thick layer of loose dust. Apparently, this part of the prison wasn't in current use, but the torches showed that someone was down here. The fourth door in the corridor showed light I was looking for. I listened, kneeling on the floor with my ear pressed against the crack, but heard nothing more than the thin crackle of a fire. The door was unlocked. I pushed it open a small crack and peered cautiously within. Jamie was there, sitting on the floor against one wall, curled into himself with his head between his knees. He was alone. The room was small but well lit, with a rather homely-looking brazier in which burned a cheery fire. For a dungeon it was remarkably cosy. The stone flags were halfway clean, and a small camp bed leaned against one wall. The room was further furnished with 2 chairs and a table, on which sat a number of objects, including a large pewter flask and horn cups. It was an astonishing sight, after my visions of dripping walls and scuttling rats. It occurred to me that perhaps the garrison officers had furnished this snuggery as a refuge in which to entertain such female companionship as they could induce to visit them within the prison. Clearly, it had the advantage of privacy over the barracks. "Jamie," I called softly. He didn't raise his head or answer me, and I felt a thrill of fear. Pausing only long enough to shut the door behind me, I crossed rapidly to him and touched his shoulder. Jamie. He looked up then. His face was dead white, unshaven, and sheened with a cold sweat that had soaked his hair and shirt. The room stank of fear and vomit.